What Mrs. Chapman described was a 8-foot-tall humanoid figure covered in hair that was dark like that of a bear, and it was walking toward their house.
News, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia in a bunker below ground, welcome one and all. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad to be your host. And getting behind the mic on this Labor Day as we go in pursuit of the enigmatic like we do every Monday night from 8 until 10 p.m. East Coast time worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com. Let's lock in. Lots to cover. Of course, Trekkies will be uniting tomorrow as we have an epic marathon in the works. More on that in a moment. Also, recently declassified footage one of the most powerful nuclear explosions in history. That, and of course, we have a big update about the Rocket Man seen in California. This has been big news for days now, and many of you have been writing in wanting me to cover who was the man in the jetpack that was seen by pilots in California. Well, this remains unresolved, but the FBI is looking into it. We will have a complete report, and then later, we will turn our attention to a favorite subject of mine and a historical perspective on what many deem to be one of the greatest hoaxes of all time. But what does this have to do with America's purported relict hominoid? That's right, the Sasquatch. We will be digging into all of that and much more this week. And of course, it's going to be a great show. Lots to cover. So hope you guys are all doing great out there. Hope it was a wonderful holiday weekend for all of you, depending on when you're hearing this. All you podcast listeners on demand out there, don't forget, of course, this podcast is available everywhere you can find great podcasts. And a few of you guys have been helping me work out the kinks with the new experiment we're doing in podcast chapters. And indeed, we have been able to confirm that some enhanced podcast apps do feature the chapters, so they allow you to skip around. You get to see the different areas where certain aspects of the subject begin. If you want to go back and revisit certain parts, you know where those segments of the program begin. So we're going to at least continue to try that. A few of you guys had recommended it. It seems to be working. I'm kind of amazed, though, that more popular podcasting apps don't actually feature that capability. But for those of you interested and who have advanced podcasting applications that you use to listen to your favorite shows, that feature will be available to you. And if you don't have that available, if when you log on and you listen, you aren't seeing a navigable chapters area, just check out Enhanced Podcast Apps by doing a search on the App Store. That should get you where you need to be. Well, so over the weekend, I was kind of tired. I had made big plans to get out, go hiking, just didn't feel like it. I've been really knee-deep in a big writing project, actually a couple of them right now, and so I've been putting a lot of attention into that and other business endeavors over the last few weeks. And so this holiday weekend comes around, and I'm all geared up and ready to go hiking and just kind of felt like laying around. Sometimes you just got to do that. And so I used this rare still moment. That's rare for me because I'm almost always on the go. But yes, I used this rare moment to catch up on a bit of binge watching on Netflix, something I haven't done in probably a couple of years, mainly because I haven't had a show on there that has held my interest. I know Jason Pentrell and I talked about that a while back. I asked him, what are your favorite movies? And he said, man, I can barely sit down and watch a movie. You know, my attention just wanders. I'd much rather be reading a book or studying something. I'm the same way. I'll put on a movie, watch a little of it, get bored, and then usually end up grabbing a book or a research paper or something that I'm more interested in. But yes, over the weekend, I have to admit, it was a guilty pleasure getting into Cobra Kai, which has been on Netflix. Of course, for those who aren't aware, this is a story that features the characters from the classic, the iconic 1980s films, The Karate Kid, starring Ralph Macchio. And not only is it great to see all of these characters now that they're all grown up, so to speak, but it's a really good series. And again, I say it's a guilty pleasure because for just about as long as I've been able to walk, I've been interested in martial arts. My father, of course, taught me Okinawan Goju-ryu when I was just a child. And actually, the progenitor of that style was Chojin Miyagi, who, as the name seems to indicate, had been influential in the creation of the famous character Mr. Miyagi in those films. Now, actor Pat Morita, of course, is no longer around, but they do make reference to his character on the show, and there are a lot of those delightful nostalgic flashbacks. So anyway, being a bit of a longtime karate geek, not just karate, I've always been interested in virtually all styles of martial arts, so it's been really fun getting caught up on that show. But here it is, Labor Day. Yeah, I know it's a holiday, but I was just too eager to get back behind the microphone and back into the game with all you guys, so I hope everyone is doing extremely well out there, whether you're celebrating, taking some time off, or it's back to work and business as usual. Although I must note, Monday may be Labor Day, but I suspect a lot of you guys out there will be celebrating on Tuesday this week, because that's right, that actually marks Star Trek Day. And Lauren brought it to my attention that a celebration will ensue tomorrow after 54 years since Star Trek first debuted, according to Space.com. And apparently, as part of the celebration, a panel discussion that will be occurring online, as everything does these days, that will be ensuing tomorrow, and guests will include stars of the show that have been a part of its history for more than half a century now, who will discuss everything from the impact that it has had on science and actual space exploration to another big deal that has always been a big part of Star Trek, and that is the message of diversity that has been such an integral part of Star Trek since its inception. And on that note, CBS All Access, apparently, who is going to be hosting this event, they've pledged to donate $1 for every person who tweets the hashtag Star Trek United Gives on Tuesday between 12 a.m. and 11:59 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time. So for everybody who tweets that hashtag, that's all you got to do. There are going to be donations in the form of $1 per tweet that CBS All Access will be putting toward organizations, they say, who do the real-world work of championing equality, social justice, and the pursuit of scientific advancements. And for those who may be wondering, the organizations that they include are the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, the National Action Council for Minorities in Engineering, and the Equal Justice Initiative. But you know, speaking to that concept that has been such a part of Star Trek, because yes, of course, in the history of the program, the first interracial kiss on television occurred, and there's quite a story behind that. But more broadly speaking, what we also see on the show is human beings interacting with different varieties of aliens from other regions of space. This is something you also encounter in Star Wars, and of course, really, it's all throughout science fiction. And I've often wondered, what would a future be like if intelligent species from different parts of space, different beings from different planets, all were able to travel around, commingle, interact with one another? Of course, there are the health and safety precautions that must be taken into consideration. You look at the situation with the coronavirus here on Earth right now, although that's not something that hasn't been considered in science fiction in the past. Look at H.G. Wells, War of the Worlds. What takes out the aliens at the end of the day? Our military can't do it. But you know what? Microbial life sure as heck could. And so that would certainly be a consideration. But if and when we ever find that alien life does exist, wouldn't those interactions be very interesting? And wouldn't they absolutely make the differences that we perceive among ourselves here on Earth to be quite insignificant indeed? And I think that that's one of the great things about science fiction. One of the big takeaways is that so many of the differences we perceive in the way that we think or that we feel or that we look, our values, our opinions, our beliefs, so many of those things that we perceive as being differences based on religion or politics or color or whatever else really are insignificant. They really are essentially constructs. And if we can recognize that, maybe we can also move beyond it. And it is fairly obvious to anybody who reads the news these days that we have a lot of work to do in that regard. But this is one reason I love science fiction and also the idea of alien life, its existence, and the search for it. It raises some really important questions, meaningful ones, I think, about what it means to be human and also how we overcome those perceptions of differences. Of course, a lot of those perceived differences also are predicated on the idea of lines that we draw on the earth, which designate who owns what territory. And hence, throughout time, a lot of wars have been waged over who owns what land. In fact, that's something that goes back to time immemorial, but we were reminded of those kinds of wars and the modern implements of destruction that have seen their furtherance recently because Russia declassified some of its footage of what was known as the Tsar Bomba, the most powerful nuclear bomb in history. Now, this explosion occurred in October 1961, a little north of the Arctic Circle on a remote island where Russia dropped the bomb in question. According to Live Science, although the bomb detonated nearly 2.5 miles above ground, the resulting shockwave stripped the island bare and flat as a skating rink. Those who were watching at the time said that from a distance of 600 miles away, you could still see the incredible flash it produced. The heat from that blast, on the other hand, could be felt as far away as 160 miles from where the actual blast occurred. Now, the Tsar Bomba, also known as RDS-220, was filmed, but no footage had been released, that is, until last week, when Rosatom State Atomic Energy Corporation, that's Russia's state atomic agency, released 40 minutes of previously classified footage that displayed the Tsar Bomba, as it was known. And of course, the blast didn't last 40 minutes. What you see in this film, apparently, is the bomb actually leaving the location where it had been manufactured all the way up to its deployment and detonation. And in fact, you can watch that on YouTube also. We will include that in the show notes. And in the spirit of the chapters that we're trying to provide in these podcasts, if you skip ahead to 22 minutes, 20 seconds in that video, you can see the blast. Although I'm sure a lot of you guys will want to probably watch the entire thing. And thanks again to the lovely Lauren Ellis for sending that story along. And it reminds me of another story my pal Roger also sent us. And this involves an update on a story that we have covered in the past. These mysterious holes that keep appearing in the Siberian tundra. According to CNN, apparently one of these was spotted while a Russian TV crew was flying over the tundra this summer. They said it was a crater, or appeared to be one, 30 meters deep and 20 meters wide. This one was incredibly large, almost perfectly symmetrical, and it aroused a lot of questions about the explosive force of nature that must have created it. Well, according to CNN, scientists aren't sure exactly how this huge hole, which is at least the ninth of its kind spotted in that region since 2013, we have reported on others. They don't know how exactly this or the others before it have formed, although there have been a lot of theories. One was that this might have been a meteorite impact. Some had proposed maybe a UFO landing had occurred, maybe the collapse of a secret underground military storage facility. However, they think, in likelihood, this is the explosive buildup of methane gas. But if that's the case, of course, researchers now want to know why these explosive buildups have occurred and why we're seeing more of them since 2013. Now, a lot of researchers have also looked at this and suggested that maybe changing temperatures on our planet could be one cause. If temperatures are warmer in this region of the world, it could be that that heat is contributing to more of these explosions. Now, they quote one of the researchers who's looking at this. He's actually the lead research scientist at the Skolkovo Institute of Science and Technology's Center for Hydrocarbon Recovery. His name is Evgeny Shuvalin. And he says, right now, there is no single accepted theory on how these complex phenomena are formed. It is possible, he notes, that they have been forming for years, but it is hard to estimate the numbers. In other words, these may not actually be a new phenomenon, but part of the problem is that these craters usually appear in uninhabited and largely pristine areas of the Arctic. And so they say there's usually nobody there to be able to see and report them. I would imagine, though, that they are more easily spotted nowadays, not only due to the prevalence of aircraft in the skies where these sorts of things might potentially appear, but also, of course, with all of the satellite imagery now at our disposal. We are able to see so much more of the world, and anybody can do that. You know, you've got NASA, you've got the European Space Agency, a lot of different organizations around the world who utilize satellites that are imaging parts of the world, actually the entire world, almost in real time, 24/7. So here again, one of the questions we might ask, which researcher Shuvalin seems to ask here as well, is, do we have an all-new phenomenon that is being influenced by changes occurring on Earth right now, or is this something that's been happening for a long time and nobody observed it? As we are going to see a little later when we get into the discussion about America's favorite relict hominoid, the Sasquatch, whether you look at this as being purely mythology, a modern folklore in the making, or if you look at this as being representative of a real flesh and blood animal that either does, or at least at one time might have existed, I think that one thing that has become evident to me from studying the history of this subject is that many people mistakenly view it as being a modern phenomenon that began all of it in 1958. And I've essentially seen that argument put forward in more skeptical books written about this subject, that it's incredible that people actually believe in this nonsense, especially if we consider the fact that the incident that put it all on the map back in 1958 was a hoax. People must be crazy to still believe this. But the other side of that argument that proponents of the existence of the creature have made is that despite the fact that skeptics argue that it all started with a hoax, what they seem to fail to recognize, or at least ignore, is that there had been a clear existing tradition of very similar experiences people had had, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, that went back centuries. And of course, the same can be said of other parts of the world. And so, of course, we'll dig more deeply into that a little later, but I do think that often the perception of a mystery as being something all new, something that has just recently begun to occur, actually has more to do with the fact that humans have only recently begun to observe it. I think the same can be said of UFOs, too. People always go back to 1947. UFOs arrive in 1947. What about the ghost rockets in 1946? What about the Foo Fighters that were seen back during the war? And if you really read deeply into the literature from over the centuries, you find similar reports involving purported anomalous phenomena in nature that occurs in the skies that go back really all the way to antiquity. And we don't have to make any claim as to what they may have been, but quite obviously, a deeper reading of history will often show that what we perceive as being new phenomena, in fact, have been with us for quite a while. And in light of all of the new things that we learn about our world, when we actually take time to look at it, when we actually pay attention to things that are going on, and we try to correlate scientific observations with historical records that might help us kind of chart the temporal relationship over time that these phenomena may have with our planet, it really gets me thinking. This world is still pretty mysterious. What's it going to be like when we get on a planet like Mars? Imagine all the stuff we'll find up there. By the way, it's about time we do a Mars update, because Elon Musk, when pressed on the question recently, apparently said that there is a good chance that settlers on Mars, the first people who actually go there, will die on Mars as well. Caroline Delbert, writing for Popular Mechanics, noted that there are already major structural questions about how humans will settle on Mars. How will we aim Musk's planned hundreds of starships at Mars during the right times for the shortest, safest trips, just being one of them? How will a spaceship turn into something that safely lands on the planet's surface? How will astronauts reasonably survive a year-long trip in cramped close quarters where maximum possible volume is allotted to supplies? All of that, she notes, before anyone ever touches the surface. But then, of course, once people get there, it's very unlikely that the first settlers will ever be able to come home. And, of course, this has been discussed plenty in the past. It's probably going to be a one-way trip. But again, this raises that question. Look at all the mysteries that we see on our planet. When we actually make it to an alien world, what's it going to be like living there? Just imagine all the weirdness we may find up there. And I will add that there is still the possibility, indistinct though it may be, but nonetheless not having been ruled out to my liking or to that of other scientists who have written about this, there is the possibility that there may still be life on Mars too. Microbial, of course, is the most likely form it will take, but nonetheless, there could be life on the red planet. And it very well may be the case that we won't really know until we can get up there and we can conduct much more detailed analyses. That is, of course, as long as we don't get up there and then accidentally contaminate the red planet and find microbes of earthly provenance that we mistake for being alien life. Who knows, we might have already done that actually. Despite our best efforts to try and sterilize everything we send into space, there's always that potential that we are the ones who are contaminating space with our earthly germs. Or if you prescribe to the panspermia idea, yeah, it could be that we actually evolved from somebody else's germs that made their way to Earth. Not impossible. But on the subject of alien life, we should mention that many are looking to the skies right now. It's become quite a pastime. And it's not every day that you see the Wall Street Journal reporting on people looking for UFOs, but that's exactly what Tae Ping Chen has been doing. Mark Brady brought this one to my attention. In the wake of the coronavirus, he says, sports stadiums have fallen silent, shopping malls have been turned into ghost towns, bars have been emptied, but the skies, depending on who you ask, have gotten a lot busier. A lot of people are observing strange things in the skies. Of course, we've been able to identify a lot of those, and I still get very excited every time I see the SpaceX Starlink constellation as it begins to pass overhead. I've seen it a few times now. But something else peculiar and wonderful that you may be seeing in the sky right now is, yes indeed, Mars. It happens to be very bright, hard to miss. In fact, actually right now, there are four planets that you can see at various times of the night and early morning. Those are Jupiter and Saturn, which you're going to see just after dark. Actually, you may see Jupiter before dark, depending on where you are. I actually was outside last night right before dark, but just after sundown, and Jupiter was already visible in the sky before any other stars. And then shortly after that, Saturn made an appearance right behind it, much smaller, but also right in the same region of the sky right now. And then if you wait a couple of hours, you'll begin to see, rising from an easterly direction, a very bright, reddish, and unmistakable light in the sky. No, it's not a flying saucer. That would be planet Mars. And then, of course, in the early morning hours, it's followed from the same direction by Venus, the morning star, arguably one of the brightest. But depending on what time of day you like to be awake, if you're a night owl or if you're a morning person, there's always something interesting to see in the sky. It always kind of amazes me how many people never look up. I mean, there are so many dynamic occurrences happening in our skies, day and night, and yet people pay no interest. If there's been one real benefit to this whole coronavirus situation, is that more people are at home at night, they're looking up, and no wonder they think that they're seeing UFOs, because they see all kinds of things they never paid any attention to before, and they can't explain them. I've got news for you. Most of them can indeed be explained, but that isn't always the case. And in fact, something very unusual occurred while pilots were en route to land in Los Angeles last Sunday night. Some of them reported seeing a guy in a jetpack and at a very unusual altitude. We're going to dig into this story, which the FBI has also been investigating, when we return right here on the Micah Hanks program. So who or what was seen in the skies over Los Angeles recently that the FBI is now investigating? Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks program, and we have quite a mystery on our hands. So this was reported last week, according to Fox 11 out of LA. The FBI will be investigating an incident that took place near Los Angeles International Airport after an American Airlines pilot reported seeing a mystery person in a jetpack flying in the path of incoming jets on Sunday evening. That would be Sunday last, not yesterday. Apparently, a spokesperson for the FBI said that they were aware of the reports by pilots on Sunday and that they're working to determine what occurred. And apparently what they have been doing as part of this investigation, we now know is they have been rounding up the usual suspects, companies that produce jetpacks, people who fly them, and they've been trying to see if anybody happened to have been in the area at that altitude at the time in question. The Star Tribune reporting here that after all, there are a handful of companies around the world that make devices that power a single person up into the air. One of the people that has been asked has been former Swiss Air Force pilot Yves Rossi. Apparently, he created a type of winged jetpack, which typically requires him to be hoisted into the sky first by a helicopter or balloon in order to operate it. Another company, Zapata, apparently has made something like a flying skateboard, which gives off a Marty McFly vibe. But here is the thing about these jetpacks. Even if someone has been carried aloft first by a helicopter so that they can get off the ground, the record flights for jetpacks are in the hundreds of feet, not thousands, and the sighting of the alleged jetpack operator last Sunday was at around 3,000 feet. So if this indeed was a person in a jetpack, as had been reported, this isn't the kind of jetpack that is known to be in operation presently, and so this has even raised questions about whether or not a new kind of technology has been developed, and some, on account of this, have gone so far as even to throw names like Skunkworks into the mix. That's right, what if Lockheed or somebody has been developing an all-new kind of jetpack technology, one that could carry somebody up to 3,000 feet? According to the Star Tribune, Jetpack Aviation Corps, based in Van Nuys, California, says it's the only one, however, that have developed a jetpack that can be worn like a backpack, as had been described in the incident last Sunday. Chief Executive David Maimon demonstrated it 5 years ago by flying around the Statue of Liberty. And so they say it's not out of the question that someone could have been soaring above the airport last weekend. However, Mr. Maimon added that if it was someone in a jetpack, it wasn't one of his. That's right, he says it has 5 jetpacks and that they are locked down, they aren't for sale. The company does offer flying lessons, but those cost you about $4,950 a pop. And further, that when they allow this, these students are actually tethered to the ground via a wire or cable. They can't actually travel far enough to account for the observation over LAX. And so this question has extended to people like Maimon, who said that, quote, this has got us all wondering whether there's been someone working in Skunkworks on this, whether or not this might be some sort of a secret project. Now, another factor that has to be considered is the fact that the FAA doesn't issue licenses specifically for operating jetpacks. It could be operated as an ultralight vehicle if it meets weight, fuel capacity, and speed requirements. But yet again, the question would have to be one of, would it be able to meet those requirements and also still carry a person aloft to the altitude in question here? Now, if it didn't, then it actually would require a special experimental certificate. And this would require a class of pilot certificate specific to the aircraft and have its own set of flight restrictions. That, according to a statement to the Star Tribune by the FAA, they say if you want to do something that's a thrill-seeking thing, in other words, pilot a experimental aircraft like this, then yes, you can fly one. However, of course, there are licensing considerations that come into effect. And in principle, I was talking with Tim McMillan about this the other day. In principle, if someone's flying over an airport, that should, of course, be a safety consideration, and a person could potentially be held liable. But Tim, of course, says that often those kinds of measures aren't enforced. And I guess I could see why, on account of the fact that if pilots are saying they see somebody that looks like they're flying a jetpack, but we can't find out who it was in the jetpack, or if indeed, if that's what was actually being flown. And so, yeah, I actually could see how the FAA might just say, well, boys, log it as a UFO, and we saw what they do when a UFO report is made, right? And that seems to be where we are right now. The FAA probably isn't very concerned or interested, and the FBI is just trying to find out if there's any kind of a paper trail. Did anybody get an experimental license? Has anybody been known to have rented an air pack from this company or that one, the ones that produce them? But to date, no one has managed to find any evidence of that. And on account of that fact, and, of course, the what I think we could fairly call anomalous height, given the fact that jetpacks that are known to exist, and they certainly do exist, but they aren't known to fly to those altitudes, some have looked at this as being possibly a misidentification. Maybe the pilots didn't see somebody in a jetpack after all. But if that wasn't what it was, then what did they see? That's a good question. Some have suggested a small helicopter of some kind, although another interesting interpretation that was reported by Fox 11, who initially broke the story, is that they say it could indeed have actually been a person flying a drone with a mannequin attached, which is actually what I had suspected early on as well. But Fox 11 quotes Lee Coates, who was the first ever female jetpack pilot, and she had said, "Sorry to say it wasn't me, but that's the story I've got and I'm sticking to it." Hopefully she says the FBI isn't listening to this, although I think that I saw her say that she actually had been contacted by the FBI, although that's not necessarily because they thought it could be her. More importantly, they were trying to get information from her, being an experienced jetpack pilot. But here's what she said about this. She conceded that it is technically possible that it was a reckless person making something in their basement, coming out and flying it straight up, but that with relation to technology she knows of, fuel range is going to be an issue. Which brings us back to our earlier point, because I've seen a lot of people saying, this could have just been a crazy experimenter, right? He didn't necessarily go and get a license. Well, that is technically possible, but it's unlikely, and I'll tell you why. And actually, I think I'll phrase this as a question. Where was the sighting of the parachute after the sighting of the guy in the jetpack? And I ask that on account of the fact that for the jetpack to function, it has to be both small enough that it can be fitted on and operated by a single individual. Can't be too large, and if it gets too large, actually, it may qualify as a different kind of aircraft. But it also has to be large enough that it has the requisite space for the fuel to be able to carry a person to the altitude in question. And so within the narrow parameters that are left, it seems highly unlikely that a person could have flown to the altitude in question, and if they had, then the jetpack probably only had enough fuel to get them to the altitude. It was a one-way trip. And unlike the one-way trip to Mars, you don't land and just stay there. If you carry yourself to a high altitude with a jetpack and you've used up all your fuel, what goes up must come down. And so the only conceivable way that a pilot who had flown to that altitude with a jetpack could actually safely land would seem to have to involve a parachute. And apparently, to my knowledge, there were no sightings of a guy in a parachute after the sightings of the guy in the jetpack. But I have seen videos online over the years of people who attach mannequins or human-like shapes to drones, or sometimes the drones themselves are built to resemble a human. And so you can have a very novel appearance of what looks like a flying humanoid. It's not impossible that that's what people had been seeing. However, what is less widely publicized is the fact that this is the most recent, but it is not the only incident involving an alleged appearance of a person in a jetpack in recent weeks. Apparently, in San Antonio, actually a few months ago, Logan Puente and his friends Brianna Chacon, Michael Oldbucker, and Ashton Simeon all said that they saw what they thought resembled a floating man rocketing into the air using a jetpack near the Hamilton Wolf jogging trail. On June 10th, this occurred shortly after 9 p.m. According to Puente, he said he went to the San Antonio Reddit page soon after, hoping to find others who had seen the same thing. He said only one other person claimed to have seen the same thing, but they all described it the same. They said it was a dude flying around. "We were dumbfounded. We thought we were hallucinating." According to Puente, he says, after thinking it over, that an open field near the San Antonio Medical Foundation is probably the likely spot where the mysterious jetpacker had been launching from. He plans on returning to see if he can spot this individual again. Now, it seems unlikely that this is in any way related to what was seen over Los Angeles recently, but there have been more than one sighting of a purported jetpack pilot, and in more than one location. So maybe it's not impossible that there is some intrepid inventor out there who is engaged in some hijinks of the aerial variety. I guess we'll have to wait and see what the FBI concludes with their investigation. And that, of course, all considering it was indeed a guy in a jetpack the pilot saw. All right, more in a moment when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. Coming at you like a guy in a jetpack, although not unsafely flying over any airports, I am Micah Hanks. Glad as always to be pursuing enigmatic subjects here on this show. Hey, have you seen a jetpack anywhere, or more importantly, a person that appears to be flying one? I want to hear from you. info@MicahHanks.com or tweet at me at Micah Hanks. I'd love to hear if anybody else has seen what they believe to be an intrepid jetpack inventor who was flying this mysterious device in plain sight. Not impossible, just unlikely. Although I am reminded of the famous airship scare of the 1890s. After people started seeing what they believed were airships in the sky, then more sightings began to occur as more people believe that they are seeing these things. It would be interesting if we ended up seeing a jetpack guy scare, a wave of jetpack sightings around the country. I guess it just depends on what you believe. But on the subject of belief, you know, that's something I try to leave out of the equation. And I think that a lot of folks don't really understand, as far as me being someone who is a little more skeptically inclined than most, why I am someone who is really interested in the subject of Sasquatch or Bigfoot. And I've often said in the past, I make no apologies for having an interest in it, even if I'm on the fence about whether or not the creature exists. And I'm not the only person who looks at it this way. Darren Naish, who is arguably one of the better skeptical cryptozoological enthusiasts, has maintained essentially the same attitude for years. He wrote for Scientific American a while back that he has a, quote, long-term, unshakable interest in Bigfoot, further noting that he's thought a lot about the subject. At least some of those thoughts, of course, he has written about. He said, I do not think that the data we have at the moment, this includes tracks, hairs, vocalizations, photos, and the innumerable eyewitness accounts, he doesn't think those provide support for the notion that Bigfoot is real, and he has come to the conclusion that it is a sociocultural phenomenon, that people are seeing all manner of different things, combining them with ideas, memes, and preconceptions that they hold in their minds, and interpreting them as encounters with a monstrous, human-like biped. And he actually wrote a book about that called Hunting Monsters back in 2016, and of course Darren's work comes highly recommended. But he also said, writing for Scientific American back in 2016, that, let me say, by the way, that I would love to be wrong. I still do hope that Bigfoot is real, that the version of the creature endorsed by the late Grover Krantz, the late John Bendernagel, and Jeffrey Meldrum, Ph.D., is accurate and valid. Fortunately, by the way, as listeners of this podcast well know, Dr. Meldrum is still among our ranks, and he sat down with me just a few months back, and we had quite a lengthy discussion about this, a portion of which I featured on this podcast as a teaser in advance of the launch of my side project, and that is the supplemental Sasquatch Tracks podcast that my pals Jeff and Smokey and I have been producing. And not only have we talked with Dr. Meldrum, but we've spoken with naturalist David George Gordon. We also had the legendary Bigfoot tracker Peter Byrne on the program. And although Dr. Krantz is no longer with us, his niece certainly is, Laura Krantz, who produced the Wild Thing podcast, and so she's been a guest on the show. We had a great chat with Laura as well. But as Darren Naish contends, there is a troubling lack of physical evidence, and he therefore concludes that this is most likely a sociocultural phenomenon, but one that he wishes existed and would like to think might still. Now, one of the reasons I've always respected Darren Naish is because he may not believe that there's evidence that supports the existence of such creatures, but he is not the kind of skeptic who says it is completely impossible, or that it is absurd for people to believe in such a creature. There are other skeptics, however, who take that approach, and further, they justify it based on the idea that the entire sum total of belief in creatures like Sasquatch, in North America at least, can all be traced back to a hoax that occurred in 1958. Now, over the course of this conversation, I intend to demonstrate that that is not a correct interpretation of the data. However, there are many skeptics who interpret the data that way, and I think we can actually demonstrate that it is incorrect, and thereby, I hope, attempt to explain why some people do believe in Bigfoot. Even some responsible zoologists, like Darren Naish, would love to be proven wrong if there were more evidence. Now, where I agree with Darren is that we have to acknowledge the troubling lack of evidence in support of a biological reality behind Bigfoot. But the skeptics who try to say that it all started in 1958 are simply wrong. And so perhaps we can find a middle path toward understanding this problem, but to understand it, we really have to look at the history. I want to lead off with an article here that I have referenced before in the past. It was written by Katie Heaney back in 2013 for Pacific Standard Magazine. And it was titled, Who Believes in Bigfoot? And then the deck, or the little subtitle under that, reads, While the origins of the mythical beast are based around a hoax, today's believers are a varied, discriminating bunch. I offer this as Exhibit A, because, again, let's start our article with the presumption that this can be shown to be a hoax that all began in 1958. Why would people then believe in such a creature's existence? Well, let's back up, because maybe a better question would be, why do people presume that Bigfoot all started as a hoax in 1958? Well, because it is true. Bigfoot, as it is known in America today, did have its genesis in 1958, at least in name. That's right, the incident which gave rise to the popular term that we recognize in association with this alleged creature, Bigfoot, that really was all born out of an incident that occurred at Bluff Creek in California in October of 1958. It actually happened back in August of that year, and it wasn't reported until October. That much is true, and as Katie wrote in her article back in 2013, in 1958, outside a logging camp near Bluff Creek, California, an employee of a Humboldt County construction company spotted a set of oversized footprints much too large to be human and too human-like to be ape. The Humboldt Times picked up the story, and the reporter, Andrew Genzoli, noted that the spotter and his construction crew, who had taken plaster casts of the prints, which were said to be about 16 inches long, had given the mystery creature responsible for them a nickname, Bigfoot. It was actually two separate words at that point. Within a few days, she notes, the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office announced that they believed the prints to be part of a hoax and that they had their suspect ready to confess. When the Times tracked the suspect, Ray Wallace, a member of the crew, down, he vehemently denied any involvement or foul play. Co-workers of Wallace's came forward with eyewitness accounts. Wallace's brother Shorty claimed that the prints couldn't have been a hoax because nobody who worked in a logging camp all day could possibly have the energy to go around planting fake Bigfoot tracks afterward. Well, 44 years later, after Ray Wallace died, his family members came forward and said, you know what? Actually, it's true. Our dad was Bigfoot. And they produced the carved wooden feet that he purportedly used to stomp the tracks all around, not only that logging camp in 1958, but maybe elsewhere in the years that followed. In fact, as a little-known aside, I think he started much earlier than 1958, and that we can trace some incidents that he probably was involved with back to 1957. More on that a little later. But as Heaney's article from 2013 notes, the person responsible for ushering the name Bigfoot into the popular lexicon was playing a joke on us all. The modern myth of Bigfoot, the tall, furry hominid with giant feet and an unparalleled knack for camouflage, was inextricably linked to the practice of hoaxing from the very start. That this is true does not, of course, deter anyone. She notes that roughly 29% of Americans believe in Bigfoot, and for each new Bigfoot sighting that makes the news, there are camps of believers and skeptics, and many switch sides from event to event without ever disavowing their general stance. There are proclaimed non-believers who saw something strange in the woods once, just as there are committed believers who insist some of the most well-known examples of evidence are completely fake. She goes on to discuss the Patterson-Gimlin film, some of the further debate between skeptics and believers, also the popular show Finding Bigfoot, which was still on television at the time, of which she notes, there is one feature of Finding Bigfoot I do find compelling, and it is the town hall meetings the show's hosts hold when they visit a town with reported sightings. Here are people who are sure they've seen something, and that that thing might be an 8-foot-tall Neanderthal-type man walking around their backyards. As she notes, despite the hoaxing, despite the utter lack of substantiated evidence, despite the scorn, these are people who think he's out there anyway. You can always tell which ones just want to be on TV. It's fewer of them than you'd think. The rest are very much sincere. The circumstances of the legend's origins don't matter so much. It's still here converting people. Bigfoot lives. The thing that really struck me when this article first appeared, which we discussed on the show years ago, and which I occasionally like to refer back to, is, first of all, Katie's apparent insistence on the fact that this all started in 1958, it was proven to be a hoax, that's where Bigfoot started, and yet people still, for some reason, believe. Now, yes, it is proven that the hoax that occurred at Bluff Creek, which gave rise to the popular name associated with the creature, yes, that was all a hoax. Yes, it absolutely was highly influential on people's belief in Bigfoot. In fact, it brought it into much broader cultural awareness. But the legend didn't necessarily begin there. And what Katie and others have over the years failed to recognize, unfortunately, is the fact that there had been an existing tradition of belief in giants in the Pacific Northwest. Some of this can be associated with traditional indigenous American beliefs, but speaking more broadly, there had been a tradition of belief in parts of the Northwest and elsewhere that had served as the basis for the Ray Wallace hoax. But what did those traditional beliefs involve? Can they in any way be associated with the modern idea of Bigfoot or Sasquatch? And does a historical analysis of those things in any way bolster the idea or the credibility of the existence of such a creature? We're going to try and look at that and much more when we return, because this is a very complex subject, which, as I have begun to see in recent years, there are questions that have arisen from debate over the name, what you call the creature, and of course what the traditions actually say. We're going to look at all of that when we return right here on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks program. Glad, as always, to be your host and to be providing insight into the enigmas of our existence. I actually think it's a good thing to be skeptical. But, of course, you can also be open-minded. That is what we try to do on this program, to analyze the facts with a little less of the bias. By the way, of course, this program, as always, is completely free and available to everyone around the globe who would like to download it. Although, if you are interested in additional content that we produce, you can become an X member. All you got to do is head over to MicahHanks.com/podcast. Right there in the upper right-hand corner of the page, you will see X memberships. And if you click that, you can sign up. It's just $7 a month or $77 a year. That gets you 1 month free. But of course, you get access not only to this podcast, but also the additional weekly show, the X podcast, and the monthly Enigmas specials. We're going to be dropping another one of those probably within the next 48 hours. So there's something to look forward to. And keep in mind, if you become an X subscriber, you get access to the entire back catalog. So there's a lot to look forward to and to be able to enjoy. But right now, looking ahead, we're going to be talking about Sasquatch, because I have been doing a lot of historical research on this subject lately. I mean, a whole lot. And a number of things have really influenced my interest in this subject. Now, I have to completely admit right here from the outset that going all the way back to about age 4 or 5, I was really interested in the subject, and my parents had given me books about this. And that interest has persisted ever since childhood. But in recent years, as I've become more involved with the anthropological community and looking at the questions of human origins and things like that, one thing that has become increasingly apparent to me is that we don't have the full picture about ancient humans and, of course, our cousins, other hominins like Neanderthals. And an interesting thing that you see in books about Sasquatch from many decades ago is that essentially all of them say, what if these represent relict populations of Neanderthals? Maybe these species didn't in fact die out. Maybe there are still little pockets around the globe where some have persisted. Well, the problem with that idea is that if a creature like Bigfoot exists, then based on the eyewitness descriptions of this creature, it absolutely is not a Neanderthal. We recognize in the fossil record what Neanderthals would have looked like. They were more robust than modern Homo sapiens sapiens, but they weren't that much bigger than us. They wouldn't have been 7 or 8 feet tall. They wouldn't have had this kind of ape-like appearance. They would have looked very much more like humans. But what's interesting about all of that to me is that people seem to be making that comparison or trying to make a connection there because that was the only other variety of archaic human that was known at the time those books were written. In recent years, we of course have identified the Denisovans, an entirely separate species, but nonetheless hominins that were like humans, more like Neanderthals than they were like humans. Of course, we've discovered Homo floresiensis on the island of Flores in Indonesia, and there are others which remain disputed as being possible other varieties of archaic hominins, like the Red Deer Cave people discovered in the Yunnan province of China, and we also have the rather enigmatic fossil jawbone known as Penghu 1, which was turned up by fishermen off the coast of Taiwan. We don't know what that thing was, and some people have looked at it and said, well, it must be Denisovan. But according to experts, if it belonged to a Denisovan, the Denisovans look nothing like what we thought they did. So in my opinion, based on what the experts like Chris Stringer and those who have devoted their life to the study of paleoanthropology have to say about this, Penghu 1, as it's known, probably isn't Denisovan. But what's really interesting about it is that we know it likely hails back to the Ice Age or the Pleistocene, although the fossil in question could be as recent as 10,000 years ago, which actually would have placed it in the early Holocene. And if something like this existed until that recently, then it really raises some questions about the completeness of the fossil record and our understanding of the different kinds of hominins, or early human relatives, that existed in it. And then you add to that the genetic studies. We talked about this with our good pal Dr. One Pagan when he was on the show. Genetic studies are showing that there are what we call ghost DNA that are evident in modern human populations. And although it's possible that what that means is that early modern humans interbred with hominins that are known in the fossil record, like Homo heidelbergensis or Homo erectus, it's also possible that the DNA that we can't identify, or the ghost traces of it, are also representative of another kind of archaic human type that we haven't identified yet in the fossil record. So all of that to say, this is a very exciting time for paleoanthropology, but we also have to look at the possibility that traditions from around the world involving belief in wild men, sightings of human-like things that seem a little more animal-like, maybe these should be considered in light of some of the recent discoveries we are seeing in paleoanthropology. But now, of course, nothing that we've gone over here necessarily supports the existence of a creature like Bigfoot or Sasquatch. And as we've already seen, many actually contend that the entire Bigfoot idea is a modern mythology. It began in 1958. That much has been clearly shown to be a hoax, and therefore there is no reason for further belief, and therefore speculation about our archaic hominin kindred is a moot point. It doesn't matter. Bigfoot is a hoax. Why would we even entertain that idea? Further, why have anthropologists like the late Grover Krantz or the late Dr. John Bendernagel, why have they entertained this idea over the years? Had they entertained the idea only before it was revealed that Ray Wallace had been involved in a hoax back in 1958? And if that were the case, now that the information about the hoax is well known, why would people like Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum continue to be proponents of the possible existence of what Dr. Meldrum calls relict hominoids? Well, to try and answer all these questions and really make sense of it requires us to go back at least to 1958 when this was all starting to happen around Bluff Creek, California. This is where most people would say that the story of Bigfoot starts, because in October of 1958, we first see the article that appears in the Humboldt Times about large, mysterious footprints found at a construction site along the Trinity River. Now, why would anyone have associated those large footprints immediately with something hairy and ape-like? Well, there are a lot of reasons why. But namely, because there was already a similar idea of a large, hairy, human-like creature on people's minds that involved the so-called abominable snowman. This was really big news at the time. In fact, California newspapers as recently as July of that same year, 1958, had carried a story about Lawrence W. Swan. He was a San Francisco State College biologist, and Swan believed that the creature existed. He'd been giving lectures about the abominable snowman. And just 4 years before that, there had also been such interest around the idea of the abominable snowman that the Daily Mail in the UK actually spent close to $1 million, and that in today's money, mind you, to dispatch a group of specialists ranging from mountain climbers to scientists to journalists, and they sent them up there for 15 weeks, along with tranquilizer guns and a large cage in case they caught this thing. Of course, they came back empty-handed, but that wasn't enough to deter Tom Slick, the American Texas oil tycoon, because he began to self-fund his own investigations into the abominable snowman. But soon, like many others, he would begin to bring his attention over to the United States after, in 1958, the initial reports of these large, human-like footprints began to appear around parts of Northern California. And so from the very outset, even though they found nothing more than large, what appeared to be, human footprints in California, from the very outset of the American Bigfoot affair, the abominable snowman had very much been on people's minds, and the immediate comparison, of course, thereafter was made. And on account of that, one of the early names that people had for Bigfoot had been Abominable Snowmen of the Americas. This was the preferred term used by Ivan Sanderson, whose book in 1961, Abominable Snowmen Legend Come to Life, was really the first one that looked exclusively at the idea of so-called relict hominoids. I don't think he used that term for them. That wouldn't come into use until the 1990s. But he certainly was looking at the idea of there being a global presence of human-like creatures around the globe that might not yet be proven to science, but nonetheless which people have said that they've seen for ages. Although, I have to note also the work of Bernard Heuvelmans, because if I don't, somebody will point out, well, you know, he wrote about that before Sanderson did. That is true. In his book, I think it was from 1955, On the Track of Unknown Animals, there were several chapters devoted to the Orang Pendek of Sumatra, the Yeti or the Abominable Snowman. Yeah, he did write about it, but it was Sanderson, his colleague, in 1961, who did the first major work that looked exclusively at the alleged existence of creatures like Bigfoot or Sasquatch around the world. Now, the events that took place at Bluff Creek, California that year, which put Bigfoot, as he became known, on the map, had initially been discovered by a man named Jerry Crew. Jerry was a very religious guy. In fact, I think later he went on to start his own parish or church. His wife had been badly injured by a fire and eventually died and left him as a single parent, so his story is sort of tragic. But based on some of the backstory of Jerry Crew that is known, we know him to have been a very sincere and honest, a religious guy. And when he arrived at his work site on the August morning in 1958, and he discovered these large human-like footprints all around his bulldozer out there in the woods where he was working, it would be safe to say that he was really bothered by this. And although Jerry certainly probably wondered if someone was playing a hoax on him, nobody else there that he worked with, Ray Wallace or his brother Shorty, the guys who actually oversaw the operation, the Wallace brothers actually ran several of these kind of logging operations in Northern California around that time, none of them were coming out and admitting to having hoaxed this. And so the best that Jerry Crew could tell, these were some kind of weird human-like footprints, and he makes a cast. And he actually carries one of these casts with him when he walks into the doors of the Humboldt Times and says, "Guys, we've got to talk." Now, there had been some chatter about these large footprints already for a number of weeks by the time October rolls around and Jerry shows up there at the Humboldt Times. Andrew Ginzoli, who would later write about this, had actually received letters from different people in the area talking about the discovery of the footprints. And so when Jerry Crew shows up with the casting, they naturally want to get a picture. And so he's standing there holding the cast, and they say, "Mr. Crew, would you like to maybe smile for the camera?" And he refused to smile, according to the story, because he said, "If I smiled, I was afraid it might give someone the impression that I had been playing a prank." And so very stern-faced, there's Jerry Crew, serious as a heart attack, holding this casting of this 16-inch human-like footprint. And you can imagine that once this goes to print in the Sunday edition of the Humboldt Times, it was a big story. But then the wire services pick it up over the next few days, and several newspapers, first in California and the Northwest, and then all throughout the country, are telling the story of Bigfoot, as he had come to be known. And it is true that in that first story, it was two separate words that appeared on October 5th, but by Monday, literally the next day, there were other newspapers that had combined them, and it was all one word, Bigfoot, with a capital B. And so Bigfoot was already appearing in the cultural lexicon as we know the term today, within just a few days of the story making news. Now, there were some who said, you know, maybe this is just a really big bear, because if you've ever seen the footprints left behind by a bear's hind paws, they actually do resemble a human foot, at times uncannily so. And trackers, of course, know to look for the marks left by the claws, which aren't always, depending on the kind of soil that the footprint is left in, they aren't always apparent. And so some folks at the time were absolutely saying, this is too big to be a human, but maybe we can't rule out the idea that it's a bear. But that idea was disputed by a couple of taxidermists from over in the Seattle area. Their names Al Corbett and Bob Titmus, his business partner. They were quoted in papers around the time saying that these were very large, but definitely human, tracks. And they had a theory about it, too, which involved a rather tragic story of a child who suffered from some mental problem who had reportedly been chained up by his family a number of years earlier. He was very large and had particularly large feet, but he reportedly broke his chain and escaped and went and lived fairly in the forest. His family had found his clothes, they didn't find him, and so the theory that was proposed by Corbett and Titmus was that this escapee had in fact been the wild man who left the footprints. Now, Bob Titmus, of course, would remain involved in the Bigfoot debate and would become pretty well known not only as an investigator, but also as a collector of the purported tracks left by the creature. Now, for reasons, of course, that are pretty obvious, many recognize this as when the entire thing began. But it's actually a little-known fact that there had been newspaper articles predating the discovery by Jerry Crew there at Bluff Creek in August, which were reported in October of 1958. There were actually articles that appeared as early as March of that year, which described similar discoveries of 16-inch footprints at other locations. Namely, there had been an article that appeared in the Reading Record Searchlight, this by Garth Sanders, and it told the story of an equipment dealer named Paul Drosher, who said that basically just like Jerry Crew, he'd found these big 16-inch footprints all in the soft soil around his bulldozer in the mornings when he would come back to his job site. But Drosher actually said he found the footprints in 1957. So keep in mind, he wasn't now coming around and after the fact claiming to have found them a year before. No, it was reported in March of 1958 that the previous year he had found large footprints, almost exactly like Jerry Crew had. I guess the only difference here being that Jerry Crew took the time to make a casting and brought it to a newspaper and said, "Look, here you go. We aren't crazy. These are what we're finding out there." Now, obviously, a lot of people suspected from the outset that this was probably a hoax. And in truth, the entire story might have ended right there had it not been for the fact that others involved at the time began to come forward claiming not only to have seen the tracks, but to have seen the track maker. It's quite a strange and at times convoluted story, which we will continue here as we probe the mythic history of the modern Bigfoot here on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. In search of Bigfoot on this week's edition of the Micah Hanks program. And more importantly, trying to understand why, if indeed, the entire story began and ended, according to some accounts, in 1958, there would still be scientists who would be interested in the idea of relict hominoids today. So we'll get to all of that, but where we left off before the break. Of course, we had the discovery of footprints in 1958. It had not been the first of its kind. It certainly wouldn't be the last. But before long, the story took on a whole new level of complexity because the Eureka Humboldt Standard, on the date of October 15th, carried the sensational headline emblazoned in all caps across the top of the front page, "Eyewitnesses See Bigfoot." Now, this story, which was written by a reporter named Bill Chambers, would end up being pretty significant because it told the account by two alleged witnesses named Ray Kerr and Leslie Brazil. They were from nearby McKinleyville, and they claimed that they had seen the track maker, which they described as a large, maybe 10-foot tall, hair-covered ape-like creature swinging its long arms as it walked across the road in front of them, maybe 40 feet in front of their car. As Kerr told Chambers as he sipped coffee sitting there by a campfire, it walked upright like a man swinging its long, hairy arms. Well, Chambers also interviewed Ray Wallace for this article and noted the fact that the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office had claimed that they thought Wallace was behind this prank. And quoting here from the article, as Chambers noted, the chat with Wallace also brought out in vehement terms that he is more than slightly perturbed over accusations allegedly made by the sheriff's office that he has perpetrated a hoax on his own construction job. And here's what Wallace had to say specifically. Who knows anybody foolish enough to ruin his own business, man? He referred to the fact that about 15 men reportedly had quit their jobs on the project since sightings of the giant feet. I've got three tractors sitting up there without operators, man. And the brush cutting crew has all quit. It just doesn't make any sense that I do anything that would cause this. The men say they quit because it's too far to drive, but I think most of them are just plain scared. Wallace further said that he would sue the blank for slander, whoever it was that had claimed that he was behind the hoax. Well, he may have been very vocal in his protests about this at the time, but again, in 2002, after he passed away, not only had his family said he did it, but they produced the wooden footprints that were allegedly used at the time and said, yeah, sure enough, our dad was Bigfoot. But what's interesting is his family hadn't been the only ones who had made that claim, nor had they been the first. Over the years, a lot of people had said that Ray Wallace had been involved with the hoax. One of them had been Steve Mathis, who was a professional hunter for the Fish and Wildlife Service between the 1940s and the 1980s. Initially, Mathis had actually been very interested in the weird footprints that were turning up at various work sites around Northern California, but when he kept going to sites that were being overseen by the Wallace brothers, and he kept finding footprints that were identical in every instance, it was clear to him that there was a hoax associated with one of the Wallace brothers, and so he dropped out. But he wrote a book called Brave and Other Stories in 1988 that actually had a chapter called The Great Hoax. And Mathis said in print in that book in 1988 that Ray Wallace had indeed been behind the entire thing. But even before that, there was another gentleman by the name of Rant Mullins. He also a former Forest Service employee. And he claimed not only to have known that Ray Wallace was the guy involved in the hoax, but that he had actually supplied him with the prints because years before, going all the way back to the 1930s, Rant Mullins said that he too had actually been involved in Bigfoot footprint fakery. Of course, they wouldn't have called it Bigfoot at the time, but he had said that he had carved wooden footprints and that he had strapped these onto boots and had worn them stomping in the earth around Mount St. Helens to try and scare huckleberry pickers. And he said it was just a prank, although notably, he said he had gotten the idea a number of years before when in 1924 a group of miners from there around Mount St. Helens claimed they'd been attacked by mountain devils, ape men they said that were 7 or 8 feet tall. Interesting point, one we'll return to a bit later. But Mullins said, you know, I regretted ever giving those things to Wallace because I put them away, and then he found out what I had done, and he wanted to borrow them, so I loaned them to Wallace. And before I know it, it's all over the newspapers. And then within a few years, people are putting on suits and stomping through the woods, and there's a film made. Yeah, Mullins didn't believe any of it, because he'd been the very first one to carry out the kind of hoax that he was now seeing all over the newspapers. And within years, we started seeing films appear purportedly showing the creature. Mullins didn't buy any of it. He said, obviously, the press was being taken advantage of. Scientists were now getting involved. He said it was not right, and I had to do something. So by as early as the 1970s, Rant Mullins had already been going to newspapers and saying, hey, I know the guy who left the footprints. I know because I gave them to him. It's all a hoax. And at least as early as the late 70s or early 1980s, there had actually been interviews with Rant Mullins associating the hoax at Bluff Creek with Ray Wallace. That's true. But in fact, there had been one other guy on record who had known perhaps as early as the 1960s. Arguably, Steve Mathis had figured it all out in 1960, but he never wrote anything about it until 88. But there is record showing that as early as 1961, Ivan T. Sanderson also suspected Ray Wallace of a hoax, and here is why. George Agogino was the anthropologist, and a very well-renowned one. In fact, he had done work at Blackwater Draw, the type site of the Clovis culture. Agogino was incredibly well-respected in the anthropological community, and he also had written the foreword for Ivan Sanderson's book, Abominable Snowmen: Legend Come to Life, because although he ended up later saying, essentially like Darren Naish does, that the absence of physical evidence leads him to be less inclined toward belief in the creatures, he was always very interested in the possibility. And in a letter that Ivan Sanderson wrote to Agogino in 1961, he told the story of a woman who owned a motel in Oregon. And she claimed that apparently between the winter of 1958 and 1959, one of the Wallace brothers and two other men had been staying at her motel. And she said that in the afternoons and evenings after they worked, they liked to sit out there on the front porch and drink beer. Now, her office was right across from where they sat and drank the beer, and so she often overheard them out there laughing and talking. And so in February 1960, she had written to Ivan Sanderson, who notably, his book had not come out yet. It wouldn't come out until 1961, but he had already written articles for men's adventure magazines like Argosy and True, and he had definitely written about this subject at the time, although he had not published his book. And so, likely having seen one of his articles, this woman writes to him in 1960 and says that she hears Wallace and the others out there on the porch drinking, and that she overhears them, quote, having a terrific laugh over the Bigfoot business and describing in detail how Ray Wallace had made them with their and others' assistance by making imitation feet, weighing them, and then being hauled up and down the slopes by the new road by means of the cables that they used for clearing the logs out of the way. So even Ivan Sanderson had his suspicions, and notably, if he had heard this in February 1960, then he probably had found out about the hoax even before Steve Mathis did. So Ivan Sanderson may have been the very first one, which of course complicates the fact that he reports on it later in his 1961 book. But then again, he had been told by a woman that she had overheard this. He didn't have any explicit proof of the hoax. Of course, the Wallace family in 2002 comes out. They say, yeah, Dad did it, and here are the footprints. Wallace, on the other hand, throughout his lifetime, never actually admitted culpability in the hoax. But it's pretty clear, in hindsight, that yes, Ray Wallace had carried out a hoax, and that many people over the years had been fooled by it. And thus, for many, that's why the Bigfoot story begins and ends in Bluff Creek in 1958. It was all a hoax. This gave rise to belief in the creature known as Bigfoot. Other hoaxers no doubt got involved after the fact, but people for some reason still believe this, even though the Wallace family finally came clean, and we now know it was a hoax. Now here's the thing. I absolutely maintain that Wallace was involved in a hoax. It was a hoax that was carried out at Bluff Creek. There were many people who were involved, and as we now see, there's also plenty in the historic record that shows that people had known about it even before 2002, and his family admitted to what he never claimed to have done in his lifetime. But we also have to ask another question. Where did Ray Wallace get the idea to leave the footprints? Well, it was probably from Rant Mullins, right? Mullins came out years later and claimed he'd been the one that gave them to him, right? Well, perhaps that had in fact been part of the inspiration behind the hoax. Although, there is evidence that also supports the idea that Wallace, like many others, had been aware of the existing traditions in the Pacific Northwest involving legends of giants. If we go back to October 15th, in Bill Chambers' article where Wallace is just going off saying he'd sue whoever it was at the Humboldt County Sheriff's Department who accused him of a hoax, right? Well, Chambers also writes, and I quote, that Wallace went into tales he has heard from Indians in the area, and further notes that Wallace recounted a story of miners that were said to have been killed by two giants in the Chetco River area. That's right, Chambers had quoted Wallace talking about legends about giants in the October 15th article. Now, why is that significant? Well, to me, because that suggests that Wallace was aware of legends about the Pacific Northwest involving, quote-unquote, Bigfeet, as they would become known thanks to him, and that this had likely been the inspiration behind the hoax. Now, some may say, but then again, how can you prove that, especially if Rant Mullins is known to have done similar hoaxes as early as the 1930s, and he says that he gave Wallace the footprints in the first place? Well, as I mentioned, Rant Mullins said that he had been inspired by the story of miners around Mount St. Helens who claimed that they were attacked by ape men. And what this referred to, of course, was the famous incident now known as the Ape Canyon incident. Fred Beck and a group of miners claimed that they were up there prospecting around Mount St. Helens and that they were all attacked by 7 to 8 foot tall hairy giants. So even if Ray Wallace hadn't necessarily been directly inspired by existing traditions of mountain devils or ape-like giants in the area, Rant Mullins, who had done the same sort of hoaxes before Ray Wallace, absolutely had been inspired by those kinds of stories. And so even if you could debate that Ray Wallace might have been inspired by another hoaxer, the original hoaxer still had been inspired by the existing traditions about giants. However, there's historical proof in the form of newspaper articles and interviews given at that time by Wallace that shows that he, too, knew about those legends, and that these had likely influenced the story about the footprints that he concocted. But why would he have done it in the first place? After all, he talks about all of his employees leaving and being scared. The Humboldt County Sheriff's Department is after him. Why would he have done something like this? And then later denied it. Well, after Wallace died in 2002, one of his associates, a man by the name of John Allman, had said he didn't remember Wallace as just trying to pull out a joke. He said it was, quote, a theft deterrent, not just a joke. That's right, he said that he remembered Wallace using the fake footprints to, quote, scare away vandals who had been messing with the vehicles, unquote. So evidently, if Allman is to be believed, it may be the case that Ray Wallace wasn't just trying to pull a prank, he actually may have been trying to protect his investments. And this might in part explain why big footprints were turning up all around equipment at Wallace Brothers sites in Northern California. But here again, we should also ask this question. Why did they think that leaving preposterously large and ridiculously human-looking footprints around these job sites, why did they think that that would have been an effective deterrent for theft and vandalism? Did they really think that people would be so naive as to believe in giants if there hadn't already been, perhaps, an existing tradition that involved those beliefs at the time that the hoax was carried out? Yet again, this brings us back to Rant Mullins, who as early as 1924 had been inspired by a story that miners told at Ape Canyon that they had been attacked by hairy mountain devils that looked like 7 to 8 foot tall gorilla men. In short, Bigfoot may have been born in 1958, but in name only. And this story, in fact, has much earlier origins involving other hoaxers. And of course, they too were influenced by those existing traditions in the Pacific Northwest about giants and mountain devils, a few of which we will look at when we return right here on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. As we're wrapping things up here, I'm sure you can tell I really enjoy not only the historical research, but also just the discussion of Bigfoot, or as it was known before 1958, Sasquatch. And I think it's important to be dispassionate about this. I'm like Darren Naish. I would love for there to be a creature. I also have to acknowledge how little physical evidence there is, but what troubles me is that even if we don't draw conclusions about the existence of the creature, I maintain this interest. And yet I see a lot of the more skeptically inclined researchers who have made some very peculiar arguments, which seem to be based on a failure to understand on their part what other writers have written over the years. I mean, one example, and again, I don't want to seem like I'm being too critical or calling anyone out, because I actually really enjoy the book Abominable Science by Daniel Loxton and Donald Prothero. It's a very skeptical look at cryptozoology. It's also a book that I think everyone who's interested in the subject should read. So there's my endorsement. But in Loxton's chapter about Bigfoot, he makes the argument that the first appearance of a creature resembling an ape-like humanoid doesn't appear until 1955. And he bases this on the fact that the writer John Green, in his book On the Track of Sasquatch, stated that a hunter named William Rowe, while he was hunting on a location, of course, I'll forever remember, it was called Micah Mountain, but he was hunting there and he saw what, for lack of a better term, was a female Bigfoot in 1955. And in the book, he notes that in the early years of his investigation, as he was gathering reports, he said that he had basically taken the legends of Sasquatch to have been describing essentially giant Indians. That was his initial takeaway, and he had gotten this impression from reading the articles by a J.W. Burns, an Irish-American author who, by 1929, had begun writing the articles referring to these mountain giants as Sasquatch. In fact, it had been his 1929 article introducing British Columbia's hairy giants that appeared in the April edition of Maclean's magazine. And of course, by introducing Sasquatch as the name for these giants, Burns did in 1929 with Sasquatch, which was an anglicized version of a Howcomelem language word. In other words, Burns borrowed it from an indigenous American term he had heard, but he does with Sasquatch what in 1958 reporters who began to cover the Bluff Creek story did with Bigfoot. And it had been reading articles like that of J.W. Burns that gave John Green early on the impression that we were just talking about giant Indians. And this is the quote from the first chapter of John Green's book, On the Track of Sasquatch. He wrote, quote, "The Sasquatch with which Mr. Burns' readers were familiar were basically giant Indians. Although avoiding civilization, they had clothes, fires, weapons, and the like, and lived in villages. They were called hairy giants, it is true, but this was taken to mean they had long hair on their heads, something along the lines of today's hippies." Unquote. So that's what John Green wrote. Now, I'll also point out that's a really bizarre interpretation of what J.W. Burns wrote as far back as 1929, for anyone especially who's read that article. And I don't doubt, by the way, that John Green had read it, but for that to have been the takeaway was extremely bizarre, as we will soon see. But coming back to Abominable Science, Daniel Loxton quotes John Green talking about this and uses this as the basis for the idea that prior to the 1950s, Sasquatch, as had been popularized in articles by J.W. Burns, simply conveyed stories of legendary giant Indians. There were no giant apes, according to this perspective. Well, Loxton further quotes John Green talking about how in the early portions of his investigation, that the first person that he encountered who told a story of a Sasquatch and describes it like a giant ape-like creature had been a hunter named William Rowe, who in 1955 claimed to have encountered one of these things on Micah Mountain, a name, of course, I'll always remember, while he was hunting bear. Now, it's important to point out, by the way, that the story of William Rowe appeared in newspapers in 1957, 1 year before the whole Bluff Creek hoax had begun. So if anybody created Bigfoot, we should say that maybe, rather than being Ray Wallace, it was actually William Rowe, because a year earlier he had written this lengthy story, which he sent as a letter to a newspaper, and it was published. And he's the one who describes in print this hairy ape-like creature. And John Green noted that in his early investigations, this was the first guy he spoke to who had given such a description. And part of the reason that this story ended up coming to light in the first place had been the fact that John Green and others at Harrison Hot Springs in British Columbia were planning a centennial celebration. And one of the ideas they had was, why don't we do a Sasquatch hunt? So they were already promoting the idea of doing a Sasquatch hunt, and since it was a big story, getting a lot of attention in the newspapers, there was a lot of discussion about Sasquatch again. And so William Rowe writes to this newspaper and says, you know, I saw one of these things. And then after Rowe publishes his account of what he said he had seen in 1955, then he gets a letter from another guy, Albert Ostman, who said that he was kidnapped by an entire family of Sasquatches way back in the 1920s. Notably, Albert Ostman also described them as being very tall, covered in hair, and ape-like in appearance. But coming back to Abominable Science, Loxton writes that Rowe's close encounter tale effectively created the modern Sasquatch, giving the cryptid its now canonical appearance and behavior. And then he returns to John Green, quoting him as having said that William Rowe was, quote, the very first to describe a Sasquatch as an ape-like creature rather than a giant Indian. Okay, so based on this, and this is what Loxton writes, and I quote, he says, before Rowe's sighting, eyewitnesses in the Fraser Valley had described Sasquatches as fundamentally human in appearance and behavior, using fire, speaking fluently, living in villages, and so on. With Rowe, the Sasquatch transformed into a mystery primate, a primate that white people could see. Well, unfortunately, that isn't correct. I mean, I really enjoyed the book, but that's not correct. That's not right at all. If you go back and you read what John Green actually wrote in On the Track of Sasquatch, right there at the end of the second paragraph, at the beginning of the second chapter of the book, here is the entire quote from John Green. He's talking about William Rowe. And he says, he, Rowe, is also one of the few people all in the first few months of the investigation who were asked to go to the trouble of having a declaration sworn attesting to the truth of his story, and he was the very first to describe a Sasquatch as an ape-like creature rather than a giant Indian. So in the context of the entire quote, it's pretty obvious that John Green is talking about the fact that in the first few months of his investigation, Rowe was the first guy he met that described Sasquatch as an ape-like creature, rather than a giant Indian, as he liked to phrase it. But on that point, I've got to take issue with John Green, because this was his big takeaway from J.W. Byrne's writing going all the way back to 1929. I want to share one of the descriptions from Byrne's article that was supplied to him by a man he identifies as Point. In later publications, his first name was given as William, but sometimes he was also described as Herbert Point. Byrnes identified him as being an indigenous American, but other accounts say that Mr. Herbert Point was actually Caucasian. In any case, the story that he told to J.W. Byrnes was as follows, and this quoted from a letter that he sent to Byrnes. He and Adeline August, his girlfriend, were walking along. He said, we were walking on the railroad track and within a short distance of the orchard when the girl noticed something walking along the track coming toward us. I looked up but paid no attention to it as I thought it was some person on his way to Agassiz. But as he came closer, we noticed that his appearance was very odd. And on coming still closer, we stood still and were astonished, seeing that the creature was naked and covered with hair like an animal. We were almost paralyzed from fear. I picked up two stones with which I intended to hit him if he attempted to molest us, but within 50 feet or so, he stood up and looked at us. He was twice as big as the average man, with hands so long they almost touched the ground. It seemed to me that his eyes were very large, and the lower part of his nose was wide and spread over the greater part of his face, which gave the creature such a frightful appearance that I ran away as fast as I could. Now, based on descriptions like that, it's rather curious that John Green interpreted the descriptions by J.W. Byrnes as having been giant Indians with long hair like hippies, because Point explicitly describes something with hair all over its body, which he then compares to an animal. Again, naked and covered with hair like an animal. Hard to miss, huh? And this is also an example of an earlier pre-1955 William Rowe description of Sasquatch as being more ape-like. 10 feet tall, wide nose, long arms that reach almost to the ground, covered in hair like an animal. But even despite everything we've looked at here, if there's any further question about whether or not we're misinterpreting what John Green had written, and maybe he did actually think that William Rowe was the first person literally ever to have described a Sasquatch as an ape-like creature, I'll draw attention to the fact that John Green also has a chapter in the same book about the so-called Ruby Creek incident, where Jeannie Chapman, an indigenous American woman, and her children were at home. And I think it was her son that first said that, "Mom, there's like what looks like a big cow coming across the field toward our house." And so she goes out back to have a look for herself, but sees that it is no cow. What Mrs. Chapman described was a 8-foot-tall humanoid figure covered in hair that was dark like that of a bear, and it was walking toward their house. And so naturally, being frightened of what she saw coming toward them, she led her children out the front door, and they ran down to the creek and were able to escape. Her husband came home later and found that a barrel of salted salmon that they'd kept in a shack behind their house had been opened by whatever it was. And an article that appeared in the British Columbia Province had actually described initially that they believed this was a bear that she had seen. However, 4 days later, a second article appeared in the same newspaper, now telling that a group of natives from Port Douglas had left in terror after a 14-foot-tall giant, according to their description. And admittedly, we've got to say that that strains credulity for the creature to have been that large, but this is what they said. A 14-foot-tall giant came out of the forests, and that they recognized this, of course, as having been one of the Sasquatch, and it scared them away, and they got in canoes and actually left Port Douglas. And as they were reporting on this, they're saying now, quoting, by the way, J.W. Burns, that they believe that the creature mistaken for a bear 4 days earlier at Ruby Creek had in fact maybe been the same creature seen by Mrs. Jeannie Chapman. Now, I bring all of this up because John Green was fascinated with this story, so much so that he returned to the site of the house which had been abandoned. The family didn't want to live there after this happened, but he went to the house, he interviewed the Chapman family, he spoke to Jeannie on a couple of occasions, and he was convinced that what she had experienced involved a Sasquatch, a tall, hair-covered, ape-like creature. But the salient point here is that the Ruby Creek incident occurred in 1941, as did the subsequent sighting there at Port Douglas. Now, if Green believed that the creature that she saw and that others saw at Port Douglas had been Sasquatches, and the description given of them was essentially the same as that given by William Rowe in 1955, but the Chapman's story dated all the way back to 1941, how could John Green have believed William Rowe was literally the first person in history to describe Sasquatch as being ape-like in appearance? Obviously, the conclusion must be that he didn't think that. It's quite evident that John Green knew that there were others prior to 1955 who gave descriptions of the creatures, which were identified as Sasquatches, as being covered all over the body with hair. But we can actually go even further back because there are plenty of other stories that appeared over the years that described similar things. Again, remember, 1929, we have the introduction of Sasquatch as the term for these creatures by J.W. Burns. October 10th, 1935, United Press carried the following story that described what they called, quote, "Sasquatch men, remnants of a lost race of wild men who inhabited the rocky regions of British Columbia centuries ago, who were reported roaming the province again." Quoting directly from the article here, they say, "The strange men, it was reported after emerging from the woods, came leaping down the jagged rocky hillside with the agility and lightness of mountain goats. Snatches of their weird language floated on the breeze across the lake to the pioneer settlement at the foot of the hills." So yes, it does make reference to language there. This is no doubt part of what Loxton and others have pointed out about the fact that early accounts involving these creatures definitely did incorporate what were perceived as more human-like behaviors. That much is absolutely true. But at the end of the article, we have the following. "People who have reported seeing the giants on their rare appearances describe them as ferocious-looking wild men, 9 feet tall and covered from head to toes with thick black hair." That was from 1935, 6 years before Ruby Creek. Now, going even further back, I want to reference the actual newspaper reports from the time that covered the Ape Canyon incident. And keep in mind, notably, since this happened in July of 1924, this actually predates J.W. Burns writing about Sasquatches. He hadn't introduced that term yet. And so prior to 1929, when you hear these kinds of reports, you're never going to see the term Sasquatch associated with it. I think that leads to further confusion. They were wild men up until 1929. Then they became Sasquatch. Then in 1958, it became Bigfoot. And it seems that every successive generation of researchers from over the years has mistaken each iteration, each different cultural name given to these things, as being the first appearance of them. And so, yes, modern reporters, as we saw at the outset of the conversation, mistake 1958 and the hoax at Bluff Creek for being the beginning and the end of Bigfoot. Why would people believe this? Why would scientists like Jeffrey Meldrum actually put their names behind this? They should be able to see by now that it was all a hoax. Evidently, there is quite a lot of confusion about this, and hence why I think it's important to note the differing attitudes toward the cultural names and the manifestations that this has taken over the years. But let's go back to July 17th, 1924 now. Let's actually look at what was reported in the New Britain Herald and other newspapers around the country after a group of miners claimed they were attacked while prospecting at Mount St. Helens. And I want you to ask yourself, as you hear the descriptions given, if there sounds like there is continuity between what they describe and what later J.W. Burns and his informants described, and later people would describe after 1958 when Bigfoot becomes a story. The article from 1924 reads, first the title, "Tribe of Ape Men, 7 to 8 feet tall, reported by Washington trappers." And now quoting from the article, they say, "While awaiting reports from parties who have gone to Spirit Lake on Mount St. Helens in quest of verification of a story told by trappers," they were initially reported as trappers rather than miners, "that they encountered a band of ape men there last week, residents today were interested in statements attributed to George Totaji," which, by the way, that's actually a misspelling. His real name was Totsji, "of the Clallam Indian tribe, that the ape men are members of a tribe of Indians known as the Siatic tribe. The trappers reported their cabin was bombarded by the ape men during the night." Totsji was quoted as saying that members of the Siatic tribe are huge in stature and hairy like beasts. These, and to use the actual term he did, being an indigenous American, had been Indians, and he believed that they talk the Clallam language and are adept at imitating the sounds of birds. So that was part of what he describes, and so obviously we can see elements in what was described in the 1924 article that carry over to the Sasquatch mythology too, and yes, that J.W. Burns wrote about this. Also in his 1929 article, we cannot ignore the fact that he tells a story about a Sasquatch woman that looks at a man named Charlie Victor after he accidentally shoots what appeared to be a white child that it was carrying and had hidden in a tree. According to Victor's story, the quote-unquote Sasquatch woman looked at him and spoke and said, "You have shot my friend." Yes, he claimed it could speak to her, and he said it even spoke what he recognized as the Douglas tongue or the Douglas language. And hence, he said, "Since I was part Douglas myself, I could understand what she was saying." And based on this, Charlie Victor's conclusion had been that the Sasquatch he observed, encountered, and actually heard speak to him angrily might have actually been related to him in some way. But although many would look at that famous case, which does describe a creature with long hair that falls to its waist, many would say, well, that's one of the giant Indians that John Green had written about. If you actually read the descriptions in the article, it describes her reaching down with a hairy arm and lifting up the injured child. So, the point is, it's a vague description, and in my opinion, with all respect for the late Mr. Charlie Victor, whomever he was, it's also a pretty outstanding story. So outstanding that it's outlandish. And we may never know if it was based in truth or if the entire thing was a concoction. Who knows? In fact, Daniel Loxton rightly asks, maybe some of J.W. Burns' informants had been pulling his leg and he just reported these stories as though they were all true, whereas clearly it seems that some of them were less so than others. But nonetheless, to try to say that before 1957 there had been no descriptions that described creatures we would identify as Sasquatch as having been ape-like in appearance, that is completely wrong. And unfortunately, that opinion seems to be based on a misunderstanding of what John Green actually meant with what he wrote. But we also have to point at John Green and say that prior to his becoming involved in the 1950s, it seems that he too at one time had only had a peripheral understanding of what J.W. Burns was conveying when he wrote about Sasquatches. So in fairness, Green did the same thing. He misinterpreted authors that came before him. And it's pretty evident that people today are still doing the same thing. There is a lot of confusion. Some of it, I think, comes from language. Some of it comes from maybe only selective reading or misinterpretation of different source materials. But a more complete and comprehensive look at the history, newspaper articles, other accounts and narratives and things that have been published over the years, and looking much further back in history at the variety of different historical accounts that seem to relate to these creatures, what we actually find is a tremendous amount of continuity between the descriptions given of them. And yet, at the end of the day, that alone does not prove the existence of Sasquatch. I'll admit that. Although I'll admit that, by looking at this subject on this episode of the podcast, it had never been my intention to try and prove anything. However, if we're going to make an argument about Sasquatch or anything else, for or against it, we really have to understand the history. And unfortunately, I've seen a lot of good researchers, both on the skeptic side and also those advocating the belief in these creatures, who have made arguments that aren't as rock solid as they think that they are. So no, we haven't proven that Sasquatch exists, but what we can certainly conclude, I think, is that there is more to this story. It goes much further back than 1958, or 1929 for that matter, and there is indeed quite a bit of continuity in the way that the narrative has developed over not just the last few decades, but in truth, over the centuries. And for ex-subscribers, we'll go even deeper into this and look at a few of the historic accounts that even predate the 20th century, which seem to suggest that whatever this represents, sociological phenomenon, cultural narrative, legends, myths, or an actual biological organism, something is going on here, and it goes much further back than most modern historians of the subject are aware. But that, of course, will be a discussion for ex-subscribers, and for the time being, that ends this week's edition of the Micah Hanks Program. Thanks to all of you guys for being here and supporting what we do. This show is produced in Asheville, North Carolina. Our executive producers back at Master Control are Race Hobbs and Warren Breger. News tips are provided by Mark Brady, Janet Fitzgerald, and Adam Olson. Music featured on this show is produced by Caleb Hanks, and other show content for this program is produced every week by the wonderful Lauren Ellis. Special thanks goes out to Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, Robin Hobbs, Tiffany Mack, Jason Pintrail, James Waldo, and Matthew Oakley. And of course, as always, I am Micah Hanks on behalf of all of us here in the bunker. Thanks for listening, and as always, stay strange out there.